Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrell has good things to report from Marja in Afghanistan.
The Taliban is clearly being squeezed by our forces, coalition forces, Afghan forces in Afghanistan, being squeezed by Pakistani military and intelligence forces.
After all, Pakistani military operatives captured Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, the Taliban's second-in-command. Signs of a new cooperation between the U.S. and a Pakistani security apparatus reluctant to help. Or maybe not. New reports say it wasn't great intelligence that captured Baradar. Pakistani forces just stumbled on him. In other words, it was luck. We got lucky when we found him. Now we're trying to give Marja a new government and win a war. And that will take a lot more than luck. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 19th. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry, and I'm here with Celeste. Celeste, the takeaway for me on the capture of Baradar is we took it early as a sign of new cooperation between the ISI, the Pakistani intel forces, and us. It turns out that if it's just luck, it may not have been quite as beneficial as we thought in the big picture.
But when you analyze pretty much any major military victory of a certain sort,
it's about luck.
It's always about right. luck. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. The latest on the Afghan offensive in Marja, now in its seventh day. At dawn this morning, U.S. helicopters dropped an elite team of Marines behind Taliban lines. It's part of an effort to break the resistance, which has intensified in parts of the city. NATO says six service members were killed yesterday alone. British Major General Nick Carter, the commando of NATO forces in southern Afghanistan, says it'll be a while before the offensive can be called a complete success.
I guess it will take us another 25 to 30 days to be entirely sure that we have secured that which needs to be secured.
A U.S. general says NATO troops now control the main roads and the markets in town.
We're also getting new details about the arrest of the Afghan Taliban's military commander, Mullah Baradar. Our partner, The New York Times, is reporting Baradar was not the target in the raid in which he was captured. U.S. officials are calling it a lucky accident. For more on the latest story, we're joined now by New York Times correspondent Rod Nordland in Kabul. Rod, we've got Baradar captured. Apparently, there were talks going on in the Maldives between the Taliban and the Afghan government. These seem to be signs that there might be an endgame developing, or am I getting ahead of us here in Afghanistan?
I think a lucky accident is not an endgame, and you know, I think they would like to see this push toward an endgame. But Marja is a pretty indecisive encounter, and the only way it will be decisive is after several months, they succeed in reestablishing government and services there and make Marja a place that won't fall back in Taliban hands the minute we pull out our troops.
Okay, Marja, an indecisive encounter, and yet we have reports that the Taliban and the Afghan government are talking or starting to talk. Rod Norland, stay with us because we're going to talk to you more about this in just a moment.
Here at home, emergency crews have recovered two bodies from the wreckage of an Austin, Texas office building crashed into yesterday by a small plane. One is apparently the pilot, Joseph Stack, who had posted a long anti-government rant on the internet. Texas police are crediting citizens like Robin DeHaven for keeping the death toll down.
I had my work truck and I had ladders. I have 6.5 years military experience in combat. I spent 2 years in Iraq assumed I could help.
DeHaven used his ladder to pull at least six people out of the burning building.
Moving to the markets now, Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down as well. The Dow gets underway this morning at 10,392. The S&P opens at 1,106 and the NASDAQ opens at 2,241.
So we're going to be talking about sports movies for those who don't like sports movies. And our question for you today, are there movies that you thought you would hate, but you ended up loving them? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE. More on Marja in a moment.
You You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this week. And, of course, I'm here with Celeste. Well, we're looking for some benchmarks in Afghanistan this morning. Today marks a week since the offensive in Marja began. Now, that included the capture of some senior Taliban leaders in Pakistan, as we just talked about. The U.S. and Afghan forces are facing remaining Taliban forces in Marja. That fight is apparently intensifying. And a week into the fighting, and with apparently some talks going on between the Taliban and Afghan government officials in the Maldive Islands, according to reports this week, the question is there any kind of endgame developing, or at least a reset of the chessboard to bring us up to speed on not only the fighting in Marja, but also what the larger picture looks like? We're joined back with us, Rob Nordland. He's foreign correspondent in Kabul for our partner, the New York Times. And also with us is Dr. Nadir Attash, a former Afghan government official and the author of Turbulence, The Tumultuous Journey of One Man's Quest for Change in Afghanistan. Thank you, gentlemen, both for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Rob Nordland in Kabul, you mentioned at the top that the fight in Marja is far from decisive. Just to start off, would you bring us up to speed on what the latest is in clashes between Afghan and U.S. forces and the Taliban, and where we stand on the takeover of Marja?
Well, it's nearly a week now since the operation began, and they're still doing mopping up. They're still trying to find mines, and they still have scattered firefights and scattered resistance. So that's not over. And they say they are starting to do some civic works, like I think they said they had a couple schools in boxes that they rolled in. They're going to set up almost immediately. But that seems a little premature if there's still shooting going on, which they say there is. But overall, I mean, Marja was pretty small change, and the casualties were very slight, and I mean that's a good thing on the civilian side, but it certainly doesn't indicate that it was the kind of huge offensive that we thought it would be.
And meanwhile,
and it's pretty clear.
Go ahead, Rob.
Sorry, it's pretty clear that most of the Taliban just cleared out and didn't bother to stay and fight. So they're still around somewhere.
And clearly living to fight another day, most likely. Well, that begs the question now, Rod Nordland, I want to ask you, because we had reports this week of talks, surprising talks going on between Taliban officials and Afghan government officials in the Maldive Islands, which suggests, I use the word endgame, but it suggests at least a contemplation of some form of endgame. How do we square a continuing fight in Marja and what you say is, you know, Taliban fighters living to fight another day and possible negotiations going on?
I don't think the one necessarily flows from the other. I mean, there have been talks at various levels between the Afghan government and the Taliban for quite some time. I mean, the UN representative in Kabul met with some senior Taliban leadership in Dubai. And in fact, there are some reports that one of the people they met in Dubai was Mullah Baradar, and that that if that's the case, you know, his arrest by the Pakistanis may actually not be a good thing for the peace process. Whoever takes his place may not be as willing to at least consider talks as he allegedly was. So it's very unclear now. And I don't really think the Maldives or whatever is happening in talks with the Taliban is a consequence of what's happening in Marja.
Okay, unconnected, says Rod Nordland. Dr. Nadir Attash, you're a former Afghan government official, and one of the things that Rod Nordland mentioned is going on in Marja now is the import of some schools in a box. General Stanley McChrystal has mentioned government in a box. Is this strategy the answer to U.S. and Afghan pacification of Marja, do you think?
I don't think so, because I don't think that there is a great deal of credibility to that assertion. If you read the reports from the locals, that assertion was met with sarcasm from the locals, because they said that we had heard the story before. I believe before the offensive of Marja, I think we should have worked on the real issues, job creation, a strong governance, rule of law, corruption, and then I think it would have been easier to capture Marja and other places that are under the insurgents rule. And I believe the timing is suspect. And also, some people really question the motive of these negotiations, because is it to deflect attention from the real issues, or rather to achieve genuine peace in Afghanistan?
But Nadir Atash, does it at least fill a vacuum, at least in the short term, that might prevent the Taliban that Rod Nordland says are living to fight another day, prevent them from pouring right back in?
I think if you look at Marja, it's a pretty insignificant place, and I think there was no urgency to capture it right now. So and there would be other Marjas. In fact, most now we see an increase in the insurgency in the northern parts of Afghanistan, which was pretty stable before. So I don't think that this kind of offensive as a strategy is going to work against a movement like Taliban and other insurgents who are non-Taliban in Afghanistan.
Rod Nordland, New York Times correspondent in Kabul. This is the first real offensive since the surge began, since Barack Obama's new strategy is at play in Afghanistan. Is there a difference in the way that the military is behaving in Marja, whether the city itself is insignificant? Is this a good, significant example of a new approach to the Afghanistan war?
Well, certainly they have a new approach, and in terms of the way they're fighting, they're doing a lot more to keep civilian casualties down, and they've succeeded in doing that. There's been only 15 confirmed cases of civilians killed in the last week. If you compare that to Fallujah, in the first week there were some 800 civilians killed. So certainly it's a different approach. Whether that's one that's going to make defeating the Taliban any quicker or easier is very much in doubt. And I agree with what your other guest said about Marja being a fairly insignificant place. There's been a huge amount of hoopla around it. It's the first big offensive since the Afghan surge in a new administration and so on. But at the end of the day, it's not terribly important. Even in Helmand, in terms of the Helmand province, it's the last big populated place that the Taliban control. But controlling large population areas is not what an insurgency needs to do to stay alive. They still have, even in Helmand, three districts where they're still pretty much in control of the territory there.
Well, Rod,
and
Rod,
you just have to go.
Rod, that's okay, because I just want to point out that in Iraq, U.S. forces often said we were squeezing a balloon. We squeeze in one place and it bulges in another place. And Dr. Nadir Atash seems to think we're squeezing a balloon in Marja. Dr. Nadir Atash, former Afghan official, and Rod Nordland, New York Times correspondent in Kabul. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us this morning. Now let's check in on some stories that we're following at 15 minutes past the hour.
More information on sharp spikes in healthcare premiums. This morning we're learning that premiums for Medicare Advantage, a popular group plan, jumped more than 14% this year. That's after an increase of only 5% in 2009. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says it's unclear why insurance companies are boosting premiums when they're making record profits.
The five largest insurers in America have declared more than $12 billion worth of profits in 2009.
Meanwhile, President Obama is ramping up his health care campaign. By Monday, he'll post his own health care proposals on the White House website. Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, now says he will testify at a congressional hearing next week about the company's safety recalls. He says he looks forward to speaking directly to Americans and Congress.
In China this morning, some reports say cyber attacks on Google have been traced to computers at two educational institutions in the country, including one with close ties to the Chinese military. Investigators say the attackers were trying to steal trade secrets and emails from human rights activists. Staying with China, China says President Obama's decision to meet with the Dalai Lama has hurt relations between the two countries. The Tibetan spiritual leader says he spoke to the president about his three big commitments.
The promotion of human value in order to bring a peaceful world, a peaceful family, peaceful individual. I mentioned that.
That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Olympics and a gold medal victory for American skater Evan Lysacek. More on that in a moment.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Thank you.
Hey, you want that to go?
And we have takeouts for you this morning on stories we're following this week. The Federal Reserve raised the interest rate that it charges on short-term loans to banks yesterday. Here to explain is Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Possibly an indication that they believe the economy is getting better. Louise, did they tell us why they decided to raise interest rates?
So, Celeste, they've been telling us for a while they were going to raise this rate. It's not just the rate they charge banks. It's the rate they charge banks for emergency borrowing. This is an emergency window, and they lowered the rate here in August 07 as the crisis was brewing. At the height of the crisis in the fall of 08, banks were borrowing about $100 billion through this discount window. Now we're down to them borrowing less than $15 billion because it's not such an emergency. They don't need to borrow as much from the Fed.
So is the average American going to see any difference in the interest rates they pay on things?
So this rate, particularly when this window is not being used, this rate does not pass through to other borrowing as much as the federal fund rates, which is the main rate people talk about with the Fed. That's expected to be raised also later on. Hasn't happened yet. But this is all the Fed exiting from these things they did during the crisis. They pulled a lot of levers, and now they're just putting them back in place. It was widely expected.
Okay, Louise Story, thanks so much. Finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times.
Now on to sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Speaking of the window, Tiger Woods has snatched the drape shut since the window was thrown open on his private life and his affairs with numerous women. Tiger Woods appears in front of the cameras for the first time today at 11, Ibrahim, since the scandal broke. Now, he's not going to be taking questions from reporters, but you have some questions you would like to be able to ask Tiger Woods.
Without a doubt, and it's not a secret that Tiger Woods is not well-liked. He's aloof and he's very controlling. But this is one of the things that I want to know. Why did you do it? You have a beautiful wife. You have beautiful kids. Why did you mess that up? And I think that's what a lot of people want to know. What on earth were you thinking,
Tiger?
Might
be asking himself that.
Precisely.
Okay.
Another one is, when are you coming back to golf? Hello, Tiger. You're the best golfer in the world. Please come back to golf. Put some of this stuff to rest. And there's a lot of people who are saying it's none of our damn business, and he doesn't need to apologize. Get back to golf and make that clear. And finally, are you more sorry that you were a cheater or that you were caught? Because that's the real question that people want to know.
Good question.
Are you really sorry that you were caught? And deep down, we want to know that Tiger, we want him to answer questions because we want to see him as a human being. So I think he's got a long way to go to win back the trust of his fans and of his potential economic supporters.
Now, what about question number two? When are you going to come back to golf? What are the signs of when he's coming back? When is he going to play? Do we know?
Some people think that this sort of announcing it at a PGA event is sort of a harbinger that he is perhaps thinking about in that direction, and maybe at Augusta he'll make his return. So we're hoping that he'll be able to, you know, play in some of the Masters and sort of put some of this behind him. I think he should go on Oprah before that, or like a Barbara Walters special.
The Oprah couch.
Right, exactly, and sort of deal with some of those issues there.
Right. All right, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks. And before you go, Ibrahim, he wants us to point out the USA plays Canada on Sunday in Olympic hockey. It's a huge game. So after you get your Tiger overdose, reset for Sunday Olympic hockey.
Our last takeout, we go to Vancouver. We're joined by Jason Stallman. He's the Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times. Jason, there's a lot of attention on men's figure skating in this Olympics. It's considered to be one of the most competitive fields for the sport this year. What happened last night?
Absolutely, it was one of the most competitive fields, and I think what happened last night caught a lot of people by surprise. Yevgeny Plushenko, the defending Olympic champion from Russia, he performs a move called the quad that not many people dare to try. Four full rotations. He pulled it off seemingly flawlessly last night, but Evan Lysacek of the United States somehow passed him up. Lysacek had most of his jumps in the second half of his program, and he was rewarded bonus points for that. Because, you know, the judges say if you're doing this late in your program, if you're doing your jumps late in your program, it's more difficult.
Because you're
and
tired.
That seemed to be the difference.
Yeah, it's a long program, and people get tired.
4.5 minutes, you should be completely exhausted by the end of it. And Lysacek was able to do most of his difficult moves toward the end, and that seemed to pay off.
So where are the standings now?
Well, Lysacek walks away with a gold medal,
yep.
And Plushenko takes a silver, and Daisuke Takashini of Japan leaves Vancouver with Asia's first medal in men's figure skating at the Olympic level.
So what happened to Johnny Weir?
Johnny Weir seemed to skate great. The fans really, really embraced him, and he was thrilled with his performance. He had a crown of red roses on his head in the kiss and cry area after his routine. He finished fifth.
And he was happy with that.
He seemed to be thrilled.
How did the audience feel?
The audience was into it. You know, they They especially got into Evgeny Plyshenko's routine. He's not typically somebody who really tries to engage the live audience, and he did that last night. So watching his performance, it was hard not to think that he had it locked up. He was making eye contact. He was nodding and thrusting his hips at the audience, and they were eating it up. And when he finished his performance, he seemed to think it was locked up. The audience seemed to, but no, Lysacek walks away with a gold.
Don't count your gold medals until they're hung about your neck, right, Jason?
Absolutely.
Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times. It is Friday, and lots of people are going to be watching Olympics over the weekend, but a lot of people are also going to be going to the movies. So our question that we're asking listeners today is about sports movies. I don't particularly like sports movies, and I'm always surprised when I like them. So we're asking listeners, were there movies that you ended up loving that you thought you were going to hate? Todd, was there?
I wasn't supposed to like it. I didn't want to like it, but I love it. Titanic.
Okay.
Love it.
Interesting. Ibrahim?
As a longtime comic books fan, I didn't think I was going to like Spider-Man, but I did love it.
You loved Spider-Man. And Louise, are any movies you expected
to
hate?
The Big Lebowski. Oh, I thought I would hate it, but now I get all those jokes about the dude.
I get it.
I'm in the conversation.
Now you abide.
The dude. I get it.
Did your husband have to explain some of them?
He did, but now I'm on the same page as the rest of society. I get it. The dude.
Louise abides.
We want to hear from you. Was there a film you expected to hate and you ended up loving it? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, how would welcoming the Dalai Lama to the White House, what kind of manners are involved in that? And when you have a handshake, does that handshake mean something different in Tibet than it does in China? We're going to talk about diplomacy and the secret codes involved in how you behave in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the Dalai Lama stopped by the White House yesterday.
I always admire America, mainly as a champion of democracy.
What's involved in that? What kind of coded message was the Dalai Lama giving in the world when he called us the champion of democracy? I don't know if there was any, but there is a lot of coded language in diplomacy, and we're going to talk about that in just a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. The fighting is turning deadlier in the Afghan town of Marja. On the seventh day of the offensive, NATO troops ran into snipers and better fortified Taliban positions. NATO says 6 service members were killed yesterday alone. Here at home, the White House has announced a $1.25 billion settlement with a group of black farmers over a civil rights case that's been around for decades. The farmers say the Agriculture Department discriminated against them for years by slow-peddling loan applications, leaving the farmers unable to plant key crops. And Americans are racking up the medals on the snow and ice in Vancouver. The U.S. is making a run at finishing the Winter Olympics with the most medals for the first time in 80 years. The medal count now stands at 18 after 4 more yesterday, including Evan Lysacek's gold in the men's figure skating.
Oh, I had so much fun tonight. I mean, I couldn't have asked for much more than that to have my personal best in the most important moment of my life. You know, I've just dreamed about it.
Tiger Woods will also be taking the podium, but not to have a gold medal hung around his neck. No national anthem for Woods. He's just expected to give an apology before he returns to his sex addiction rehab in Mississippi. Baseball star Mike McGuire, who recently admitted to past steroid use, thinks Tiger can make a comeback.
One of the strongest individuals I've ever met, mentally, physically. He'll be just fine.
Tiger will speak at 11 a.m. Eastern Time.
For the first time in its history, meanwhile, Walmart's sales are down in the U.S. The world's largest retail chain posted a 0.5% decline last quarter. Walmart still had over $70 billion in U.S. sales, however. And the Federal Reserve has decided to boost the rate banks pay for emergency loans. You just heard Louise's story talking about that. The move won't directly affect borrowing costs for Americans, only for banks, and it goes into effect today. Let's now see how the markets are reacting or will react. Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down as well. The Dow gets underway this morning at 10,392. The S&P opens at 1,106, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,241. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Yesterday, Barack Obama complicated U.S.-China relations by welcoming the Dalai Lama to the White House. Now, granted, the Dalai Lama was in the map room, not the Oval Office, and that's a secret code. That means it wasn't as important a meeting as if they'd met in the Oval Office, but you have to know the code in order to interpret it properly. To explain all this sort of diplomatic code language, we have David Banks with us. David says diplomats in the West see meetings like yesterday's very differently from diplomats in the East. Good morning, David, and welcome to The Takeaway.
Good morning.
So there's this ritualistic language that's involved in diplomacy. Can you kind of give us some examples of things which maybe are not spoken, unspoken, handshakes or photo ops that mean something important on the global stage?
Yeah, there's a lot of conventions internationally that are understood by diplomats and foreign offices as sort of a tea leaf, sort of codes you can read. And so things like very often you'll see there's jockeying for position or discussions over things like seating arrangements at meetings, where people stand on dioceses, podiums, who speaks first, who enters a room first. Now, these things are kind of, they're not very important to ordinary people, but these are the kind of things that you find diplomats obsessing over sometimes.
Well, David, you're actually a doctoral researcher in what's called ritual and symbolic diplomacy. Can you explain the symbolic diplomacy, the diplomacy that goes on in terms of symbols? I mean, does it matter what people wear? Does it matter how low they bow, as we saw in Japan?
The Japan example is an excellent example of this. So it does matter, is the short of it, and it matters a great deal for states' sense of the sort of prestige or honor. So in Obama's instance in Japan, what happened there was that according to diplomatic protocol at the international level, you're expected to observe the welcoming traditions of the host country. So President Obama didn't actually do anything unusual or especially strange when he bowed in front of the emperor. In fact, the only strange thing is he also shook his hand, which you're not supposed to do in Japan. So he just kind of confused the ritual rather than actually mess it up. What's interesting, though, is, of course, that that's the international language of symbols, but the domestic language of symbols in the U.S. is different. So that was construed by a great deal of great many people in the U.S. as being a sort of a submissive move on Obama's part, which at the international level, it wouldn't be interpreted like that at all.
So, David Banks, this is Todd Zwillick here. How you doing?
Hi, how are you?
David, so in the events of yesterday, translate for us, President Obama meets with the Dalai Lama, okay, but as Celeste said, meets with the Dalai Lama in the map room of the White House, not in the Oval Office. What does that mean in American? What does that mean in Chinese?
Right. Well, so firstly, I've got to caveat the point by saying that the meaning, symbolic meanings are never fully clear, which is part of the power that they have. It lets countries sort of state things or infer things without actually having to say them out loud. But I will give you my translation of what I would think he's trying to say. I think that by President Obama meeting the Dalai Lama in the White House, this is a symbol that American domestic audiences can understand quite clearly. It means, you know, this is an important figure for us, and the Dalai Lama has got a sort of huge symbolic association with human rights, so that domestic audiences in the U.S. can understand this quite clearly. At the international level, so for international audiences and certainly for the Chinese administration, for the way they should read this is, yes, the Dalai Lama matters to us, but look, we're not suggesting he's the leader of Tibet, because if he was the leader of Tibet, we'd bring him into the Oval Office and not the map room. So we're bringing him into the map room because we're trying to say, yes, he matters, but maybe you shouldn't worry too much. And it should be noted that, as far as I found out about this, the Chinese were quite concerned about exactly who would be meeting in the room, would the First Lady be there, and all this kind of stuff. And I think it speaks volumes that the Obama administration didn't allow the press to be there, that they released their own photos, because this way it means they can very much control the symbolic message they're trying to convey.
Well, did it mean something different to the Tibetans?
Unfortunately, I don't know how this is playing out at all in Tibet or in China, and I don't know enough really about how the kind of medias operate in those countries. But I think the point that I'm trying to make is that symbols, they don't actually speak for themselves, and what they really require is interpreters. And so this means that symbolic language can be interpreted different ways by different audiences, which is what happened with President Obama in Japan, and is also what I think consciously the White House were trying to do yesterday.
Well, you know, for the average person who's never going to have to worry about whether how low they bow to the emperor in Japan or whether or not they host the Dalai Lama in the map room or the Oval Office, it seems to me like this kind of symbolic ritual language actually comes into play all the time for all of us. I was thinking about like in the Da Vinci Code, all the codes that painters used to put into their paintings, or even when you go to Thanksgiving dinner or a wedding, where you place people at a wedding table matters. I mean, manners matter.
Yeah, they do matter. I mean, they absolutely do, and that's certainly what I'm interested in terms of the research. I think the problem with symbolic language is, like I said a second ago, is it's not actually the meaning is not inherent in the symbols themselves. We associate meaning with symbols, but it's completely in our own social context. So flags have certain meanings, or historical traditions have certain meanings in the U.S. that they don't have in other countries, and vice versa. So in terms of can you use this as a guide in your life, you need to know what the conventions are first, and then especially if the other person knows that you should know the conventions and then you don't follow them, that's when I think you start to see problems. I think when people aren't expected to know, then people don't mind.
But is it okay to do in diplomacy what we do in real life, which is to talk about it and say, oh, whoops, gosh, I really didn't mean that. I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Well, is it okay to do in diplomacy what we do in real life, apologize and say, I didn't realize?
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. But not if, like I said, it's assumed that you should have known beforehand. So very often world leaders who aren't especially savvy in these codes themselves might meet and do something, okay, and that would be ignored. But if they were had met with their foreign officer, the protocol officer beforehand, and then did it, I think most other countries would assume there was a certain amount of intentional insult.
No forgiveness for ignorance there. David Banks, doctoral researcher on ritual and symbolic diplomacy at George Washington University. Coming up, we're going to be talking about movies, and we're going to talk about sports movies today. Not sports movies for the sports fans, sports movies for the people who hate sports. It's coming away.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Elections in Iraq are less than a month away, and there have been serious concerns raised in Washington this week about the influence that neighboring Iran may be having on Iraqi elections. The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse has just been embedded with American forces operating on Iraq's border. He joined me earlier to talk about the mission.
I was in Diyala province, which shares a long border in eastern Iraq with Iran. Now, the official narrative here from the U.S. military is that they're here in support of Iraqi forces. They're training them. They're helping them whenever the Iraqis request it. Now, we went out on some patrols both night and day along the border. They still say it's them backing up the Iraqis, but in fact, the numbers of Americans on these operations was actually much larger than the Iraqis. So I think there's a slight disconnect really between the what's being said officially and what's actually going on. What they were doing is going along the border trying to spot contraband coming through, specifically weapons smuggling. There are two things most specifically that they're looking for. One is rockets, some of the rockets that we see fired in and around southern Iraq and also sometimes in Baghdad, and also these explosively shaped projectiles that can pierce through the U.S. troops' armored vehicles. Now, the Americans and the Iraqis themselves, indeed, believe that these are coming across the border from Iran and still causing havoc here in Iraq.
And while you were there, Gabriel, you spoke with a U.S. commander on the ground. That's Colonel Dave Funk. Let's hear what he told you.
We have reflections mostly from the Iraqis who say that there is Quds Force influence here, along with other special agents from Iran. Quite frankly, we can't confirm or deny that, but we do know that a lot of the arms, ammunition, and explosives that we find here being used against Iraqi security forces, our forces, and against the Iraqi people clearly have originated from Iran.
Now, what he's talking about there is Iranian influence in Iraq, not only against U.S. troops, but on Iraqi politics, right?
That's right. When he mentions the Al-Quds Force, that links directly into the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which, of course, provides a link with the Iranian government. Now, if you go higher up the chain of command in the American military, we see General Odierno saying at the beginning of this week that he thought Iran was exercising a malign influence ahead of these elections, that it was trying to interfere in the politics. That's something echoed by Christopher Hill, the ambassador here, saying that two Shiite politicians who had come up with a list of banned Sunni candidates for this March election had strong links to Tehran. They said they had direct intelligence linking them, suggesting very heavily that this list of candidates that's been banned, which has been causing huge controversy here, was somehow cooked up at the behest of Iran.
What does Iran have to gain by trying to influence the elections, presumably on the Shia side?
I think Iran sees American troops here departing. They see a power vacuum emerging, I think, and they would very much like to be able to have some kind of control over the government in Iraq. There's a lot of oil here, obviously. It's a big neighbor. There's a lot of trade to be done. Now, a lot of the Shiite politicians have strong ties to Iran under Saddam Hussein. Many of them were in exile in Tehran. There's a lot of money coming in from Iran funding these Shiite parties. So it seems quite clear that the preference in Tehran is for some kind of Shiite coalition over a Sunni victory in this election.
The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse, who talked to me earlier about the border between Iraq and Iran and Iranian influence he has witnessed pouring into Iraq ahead of that country's elections next month.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Todd Zwillick, who is filling in for John Hockenberry. Coming up, we're going to talk about sports movies that everybody can love, even people who don't like sports. And in honor of the topic, we're going to have sports movie trivia today. So here's the question. Sports stars have made tons of cameo appearances in movies. So I want you to name the movies in which the following athletes have appeared. 1, Lance Armstrong. 2, Mike Tyson. And 3, Anna Kournikova. Know the answer? You can give us a call at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post it on our Facebook site.
You can get some bonus points because those are three, but there are lots of others too. God, there must be dozens of sports stars in movies right now. Right now, let's take a check on headlines at 48 minutes past the hour. The U.S. racked up 4 more medals at the Olympics yesterday, including a gold in men's figure skating, but U.S. alpine skier Lindsey Vonn wasn't one of the winners. She fell during the slalom event.
I just was fighting hard and I hooked a tip. It happens in slalom, and I was hoping that it wasn't going to happen today, but I gave it my best. I skied well on the downhill, and I thought I was skiing well on the top of the slalom, but just wasn't my day.
Vonn says she's going to rest today and get her injured leg ready for tomorrow's events. More on rising health care costs this morning. Today we're learning that Medicare Advantage, which is a Medicare group managed care plan, boosted their premiums by more than 14% this year. That's compared with a 5% increase in 2009. Meanwhile, the president says he'll post specific proposals for comprehensive health care reform on the White House website by Monday.
In economic news, the Federal Reserve has decided to raise the interest rate on the short-term loans it gives banks. That raises the discount rate to 7.0.75%. To look at how this is being seen internationally, we've got BBC Economics correspondent Andrew Walker with us this morning. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Celeste.
So we've heard that this tiny raise in interest rates is actually pushing the dollar higher.
Yeah, it has had a noticeable impact on financial markets. The dollar's one part of it, very important part of it, and also on stock markets in Asia particularly. Tokyo and Hong Kong both fell by more than 2%, and it was largely down to the Fed's move. And we've seen some smaller falls in the main European markets. But I do think the most striking movement has been on the dollar, turning it the other way round, as it were. The euro is actually down by more than a cent, below $1.35, first time in a while, and the pound's down even further by almost 3 cents. So, yeah, quite a marked impact, and that's investors thinking what's happening in the States maybe means there's more money to be made by putting your investments into interest-bearing accounts on that side of the Atlantic.
A small glimmer of hope. That's BBC Economics correspondent Andrew Walker joining us from London. And in other news, Bernie Kerik, the New York City's police commissioner during the September 11th attacks, has been sentenced to 4 years in prison. He was convicted of 8 felonies last year, including filing false taxes and lying. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
Movie Fridays on The Takeaway. Today's movie segment is dedicated to all you people out there who, frankly, couldn't care less about the Olympics or the Super Bowl for that matter, but are forced to live in a world where everyone else does. Our theme, sports movies for people who don't like sports. Sports movies that even a nerd could love, maybe. Chris Ryan from RollingStones.com is an expert in the area. Nerd or movie critic, or maybe both. He's seen a lot of movies and a lot of sports movies, and he knows which ones are for sports fans only and which ones you can enjoy even if you really and truly hate the sports but you love film. And why would you hate sports? I guess that's for another segment,
right?
Team sports not so much for me, the individual ones I can get into. But Chris, just to start off, what makes a sports movie palatable for the sports hater? When does the sports not really matter?
I think the rule of thumb that you really have to follow here is the sport going to be central to the movie? Is that going to be the main character? So if your enjoyment of the film winds up hinging on whether or not a team or an athlete wins at the end, then you're probably going to be disappointed. Also, you want to avoid those sports movies that are really overdone with a lot of the rules of the game or the intricacies or details of a certain sport. So say a movie like Hoosiers is probably going to be disappointing because Hoosiers is about basketball.
Right.
Whether
they win or lose.
Exactly.
In the end.
And the entire film is dedicated to the coaching of basketball, the playing of basketball, what basketball means to a community, et cetera.
You know, that reminds me of Dodgeball. Dodgeball was really about dodgeball. There's a scene where they went through the rules. They explained what happens when you catch a ball, get hit by a ball, that you have to dip, dive, duck, dodge, and dive.
Yes.
That movie was all about dodgeball and nothing else.
Yeah, it's sort of the bizarro version of Hoosiers, I suppose.
Right, very bizarro. I think that movie was about nothing, not even dodgeball. It was just about a cheap laugh. Well, Chris, you and our producer, Kristen Meisner, have made a list of your top 10 movies for people who – sports movies for people who hate sports. Listeners, of course, you all can go on the website at thetakeaway.org and vote for your favorites or nominate your own. I just want to walk through a couple of these with you. Chris, your first pick was Blades of Glory.
Yeah.
Chaz Michael Michaels, an ice-devouring sex tornado spawned in the hellfires of Motown.
Troubled childhood? If you call being a 9-year-old kid with a 35-year-old girlfriend troubled.
Blades of Glory?
Yeah, well, Blades of Glory, I think this is for all our newfound Evan Lysacek fans out there. It's a great lampoon of our obsession with biographies. Or when you're watching the Olympics these days, I'm sure everybody's got their story they have to tell. Well, the stories in Blades of Glory are absolutely ridiculous. It's about the first male-male figure skating duo. It's played by Will Ferrell and John Heder from Napoleon Dynamite. It's got incredible villains played by Will Arnett and Amy Poehler. And it's just a great satire of the campy world of figure skating as well as sort of macho homophobia.
And in a way, it was sort of the dodgeball of the figure skating world. I know I'm obsessing over dodgeball, but let me have a moment of honesty. I love that movie. All right, here's another clip from your list, Chris.
Hell, I don't want to go to college, Dad. To hell with them.
What, are you afraid?
Yeah. A little bit.
What are we listening to there?
Well, that's Breaking Away. It's a 70s coming-of-age film starring Dennis Quaid and Dennis Christopher.
Around cycling.
Yes, and it's sort of like a Bruce Springsteen song come to life if you replace 67 Chevys with Italian bicycles. It's about a bunch of kids living in Bloomington who are trying to get out of their hometown while still sort of embracing the qualities that make it great.
So you've described that a sports movie for a non-sports lover shouldn't be directly about the sports. It should be incidental.
Like, right.
It could take place in an office, for instance.
Sure, exactly. I think that that's a great movie in any case. I mean, you want to have a film where you can transpose the plot into any kind of setting, but you'd still have the same sort of qualities for the story. So if you took an office or a workplace comedy, but you could also transpose it into sports, you could transpose it into whatever, it would still succeed.
Let me toss a couple of these at you.
Sure.
And from the world of baseball, for instance, you tell me if you think these sports movies fit into your template for good sports movies for non-sports lovers. A movie like Bull Durham strikes me that it's about romance. It's a little bit about baseball, but not so much.
Well, yeah, in Bull Durham, I think the baseball is more of a metaphor, whereas, you know, something like The Natural, I think even though that's also a metaphorical
Robert
film
Redford.
Too, that's very much about whether or not he succeeds as a baseball player. Bull Durham's about whether or not they succeed as a couple.
Right, that's Bull Durham is Kevin Costner. And Kevin Costner also in Field of Dreams.
Yes. Which is another film where I think that you don't have to love baseball to love that movie. It's about loving something so much that you can't give it. It's about faith and hope and loving something so much that you can't give up a dream.
I'm a hockey fan and a former resident of Montreal, Canada, so I have to ask about a favorite of college kids from all across Canada, Slapshot, starring Paul Newman. It's a pretty hockey-heavy movie, but a big comedy. Can you love Slapshot if you don't love hockey?
I'd say you could love Slapshot if you love profanity. It's maybe one of the funniest movies ever made, and it's also one of the most profane movies ever made.
Let us not forget about the Hanson brothers,
no,
right?
Of course, yeah.
Putting on the foil to start a fight. That's Slapshot with Paul Newman. Chris Ryan is a freelance writer. He writes for Spin and for RollingStone.com, joining us in the studio to talk about sports movies that even you sports haters can love during the Olympics and in the aftermath of the Super Bowl.
Okay, so Chris, we have this trivia question for you. You know, sports stars often make appearances in movies, and so we're asking you, in which movies did the following athletes appear? Number one, Lance Armstrong.
I am wrong, but I am going to say there's something about Mary.
You are wrong. It's actually the movie that Todd loves. It's Dodgeball.
Okay.
Aren't you Peter LaFleur?
Lance Armstrong?
Yeah, that's me. No, but I'm a big fan of yours.
Really?
Yeah, I've been watching the dodgeball tournament on the Ocho.
That was Brett Favre, who was in something about Mary.
Right, yeah.
Anna Kournikova.
I have no idea.
She was actually the motel manager in Me, Myself, and Irene. And the last one for you, Mike Tyson.
That would be The Hangover.
Mike Tyson. This is my favorite part coming up right now. I can feel it coming in the air tonight.
The payoff, Mike Tyson singing. Again, we have that list of good sports movies for non-sports watchers on our website. You can also vote for your favorite and suggest your own at thetakeaway.org. And we're asking you today, what's a film that you thought you would hate, whether it was a sports movie or not? Did you think you were going to hate a movie and then you went in and watched it and it ended up becoming one of your favorites?
It's Paul from Parsippany, New Jersey. Sports movies that I didn't expect much of that totally blew me away. The Replacements.
I know you're tired. I know you're hurting, and I wish I could say something that was classy and inspirational, but that just wouldn't be our style.
I went out and bought it, washed it 3-4 times a year. It moves me every time.
Pain heals. Chicks dig scars. Glory lasts forever.
I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.